So it's a great pleasure to be here. So I want to thank the organizers for asking me to give this talk. This is about a joint work with Andrei Losev and Nikita Nekrasov. And in fact, this I will sort of pick up where Nikita left off yesterday. This is a project which we actually started 3.5 years ago while we were both visiting KNATP, so it's a very good environment for us. Since that time, there are two papers which are in the archive, and there is supposed to be a third one which we are working on right now, which is actually the closest to the subject of this concentration period on pure spinners. Okay, so yesterday Nikita told us about, introduced us to the pure spinner formalism, and part of the story was the curved beta gamma system. So this is supposed to be some kind of a chiral cone field theory in which the action is given by something like beta I, d bar, gamma I, where gamma I's are some coordinates. Gamma I represent the coordinate system. On some target manifold. And more specifically, in the pure spinner formalism, this X, as Nikita explained to us, is a C-star bundle. X is a C-star bundle over SO10 divided by U5. So what we'd like to do is to make sense of this. And he explained yesterday that there are all kinds of issues in making sure that this is really a well-defined quantum field theory. There are all kinds of anomalies that one has to deal with. And remarkably, in this particular case, if you make a right choice of a target manifold and make various adjustments, then you actually see those anomalies go away, which sounds very reassuring. You're right, the problem. But we wanted to look at this from a more general point of view. In other words, not necessarily for this particular target X, but in a more general situation. In fact, there is one class of targets, though, which is very closely related. And this class consists of the flag manifolds, which are also quotients of compact groups by subgroups. So another example, which is interesting from a different point of view, is when X is a G mod T, where G is a compact three group and T is a maximal torus. So, for example, you can take SUN divided by U1 to the N, which for n equal 2 would be SU2 divided by U1, which is CP1. So you can think of this as a baby version of the pure spinner formalism, where instead of this manifold, this complicated manifold, you take CP1. And you try to make sense of this curved beta gamma system. This actually, this is very interesting for various reasons. One reason is that this curved beta gamma systems with such targets show up in the geometric Langlands program. So there are two known ways of relating geometric Langlands to quantum physics. And one of them I will talk about tomorrow and Friday at 3:30 at the Magic Park. And that's the connection. Sorry. Don't miss the cookies at 3 o'clock. And that's the connection between geometric Langlands and four-dimensional Young Mills, studied by Kapustin-Witten, Gukov-Witten, and others. So that has to do with dimensional reduction from four-dimensional Young Mills to two-dimensional sigma model with some fancy target space. Okay, so that's one way. But there is also another way, which is the connection to this kind of sigma models. And the point is that these models are going, so in this case, Nikita explained that there are two anomalies which show up in here. One is a C1 anomaly. So the hardest anomaly is the P1 anomaly. And fortunately, so he actually had to work to make this P1 vanish. For example, if he took a line bundle, it wouldn't work, but C-star bundle, P1 vanished. Okay. P1 does vanish for these flag manifolds, for full flag manifolds, not for partial flag manifolds. For example, if you take CPN, where n is greater than 1, P1 anomaly will not vanish. But for full flag manifolds like this, it will vanish. So that's the first anomaly. And then there's a second anomaly, which is a C1 anomaly, which if P1 vanishes, you presumably get always a well-defined cone field theory, but it's not going to be conformal unless C1 vanishes. So here, actually, C1 does not vanish. It's not going to be conformal field theory. And yet, so in other words, it doesn't have a stress tensor, but it has a Kac-Moody algebra, a Kac-Moody symmetry. It has a Kac-Moody symmetry at a kind of a very fancy level, which is called the minus dual Coxeter number, a critical level, where actually Shugawara construction breaks down. So it's actually consistent, so you don't expect to get a stress tensor, it's not conformal. But you do get something which kind of is very close, because you get an infinite dimensional algebra of symmetries. That Kac-Moody algebra related to this G at this very strange variable of the level. And that is known to be related to the geometric Langlands. So that's the reason why we actually wanted to understand these models, because we thought that this would actually give us, shed some light and give us some insights into the geometric Langlands. Okay.
Can you take a C-star bundle over those?
You could, yeah. You could. But here, actually, you don't need to, because it's already P1 is already 0.
But maybe C1 would be 0.
Right, you could. You could do that. Right, right. So, of course, there are many versions that you can play with. Right, you could make conformal field theory. One more point, one more interesting observation, which is that there is an old work by Fatih, Frolov, and Schwartz. In which they studied this model. More precisely, they actually had the chiral and anti-chiral degrees of freedom. You could also have this.
For CP1.
They didn't quite say it this way, but actually what they were doing is really studying this bosonic sigma model in this limit, which I'm going to explain in more detail in a minute. And so they had a very interesting and very surprising observation, or a very surprising result, that this model actually is equivalent to the Coulomb gas of massive charged massive fermions. And so geometrically, this is very clear. I mean, the geometric interpretation of this is very clear, because basically in this limit, as I will explain in a minute, what survives are the instantons, and somehow the path integral actually localizes on the moduli space of instantons. And here, instantons are holomorphic maps. Holomorphic maps from your world sheet. Let's say your world sheet is just CP1 also. So CP1 also to your target, which is just happens to be CP1 as well. So what is a holomorphic map from a CP1 to a CP1? It's just a meromorphic function. Meromorphic function. And the meromorphic function is described by zeros and poles. So a degree n map will have n zeros and n poles. So in particular, one instanton will be determined by the 0, 1, 2, 1, 0, and 1 pole. So you can kind of think of instanton as a particle which consists of two quarks. One is mirons. One is a zero corresponds to zero, one corresponds to the pole. So in other words, you can try to introduce some operators in the theory which create zeros and create poles. And of course, you cannot create just one zero or one pole. You can only create pairs. There is some kind of a charge conservation which prevents you from doing that. And these are the fermions. So this corresponds to one fermion, this corresponds to the other fermion. And so we were very interested in, with Andrei and Nikita, we were very interested in seeing how this how to interpret this from this sort of more modern language of curved beta gamma systems, and also how to relate that to this, what I just said, connection to Langlands, and the appearance of the affine Kac-Moody algebra symmetry. And so, for example, one thing which we discovered here is that in this model studied by Patiev and Schwartz, in addition to this fermions, you actually have an SL2 hat Kac-Moody algebra at level minus. So, presumably, and Nikita and I talked about it a little bit, presumably there could be a similar description of the pure spinner formalism by kind of neurons, kind of fermionic types, but this is still an interesting open question.
Do you have anti-insignificant?
Right, so this is the point. So this is, now I come to the main point. So we have to explain what kind of model this is, right? And so the main feature of this model is that actually what this is, I mean, here is a, it looks like a first order action. So it's not obvious what it has to do with sigma models, if you just look at it. But the point is, which Nikita already explained yesterday, that you get this action in a very peculiar limit of the usual sigma model. And the limit is the infinite radius limit, but not just infinite radius, it's an infinite radius limit where you also add an infinite B field. Which is imaginary. So the theory is actually non-unitary here. But the effect of this is these two things conspire in such a way that in this model, instantons live and actually become, their contribution is sort of on par with small fluctuations around constant maps, but anti-instantons die. So it's a theory in which kind of is the disparity between instantons and anti-instantons. So we don't see the anti-instantons. Now, the idea of this project is to use this theory, use this particular limit as a starting point for a perturbation theory. So this is very different from starting from a free field theory, say, and doing the usual perturbation theory, because, of course, that's where it's very hard to catch the instantons. But here we already have the instantons from the beginning built in. And in fact, as I will explain, the theory is kind of, it's sort of exactly solvable in the following sense, that the path integral, which usually is an integral with some ill-defined infinite dimensional space, is actually an integral over finite dimensional space. More precisely, it's a sum of integrals over some finite dimensional moduli space corresponding to different charges of the instantons. Okay? And so in this limit, the theory can be solved exactly. And therefore, we can then try to turn on the anti-instantons and go back and try to go back to the physical regime of coupling constants and try to get to the physical theory by using this as a starting point. That's the idea. Now, of course, we would like to do it in this bosonic for these bosonic models. One, the first reason is because we want to understand pure spinners. The second reason I explained here. But bosonic theory is hard. So what we decided to do is to first look at the supersymmetric version. So if you throw in enough supersymmetry, then this anomalies which plague the bosonic theory actually go away, and the measure of path integral becomes well-defined. And so it's sort of canonical, well-defined. And so, so a lot of things become easier, but still the theory is very interesting, and we wanted to first analyze the supersymmetric theory to understand how things work. And that's the subject of this part one and part two. But the subject of part three is the bosonic theories. Right, so that's the structure of this.
Sorry, small question.
Yes?
So in this map, what is related to the mass of the fermion in the CT1 sigma model?
It's kind of the instanton parameter. It's e to the tau. It's e to the tau, right? Q, it's Q. I don't know what you call it. Instanton. It's a counting parameter when you count instantons. Instantons of
the
Lambda. Yeah. Okay. That's the
so mass. This is quantum soliton then, quantum instanton. It's not classical solution.
Is it classical solution? Classical solution.
You mean sum over all instantons? Yes. CP1 sigma model has only coupling.
CP1 sigma model has instantons, and
it's a model of so-called
free fields with addition of terms with generators.
You do have instanton parameter, right? You have the B field which enters in the counting. So if you have instanton of degree n, you will get Q to the n.
But I thought you were solving the classical equation of motion.
Okay. What do you mean by classical
equation? If it is a confinement scale, okay, that's fine. Okay, but
classical equation motions are equations of full motion in this theory, by the way. So, but there's a kind of a t-duality transformation which goes on, which gives you this description by using fermions, which is kind of similar to what kind of t-duality we talked about yesterday. All right. So now I want to talk about more specifically about these models. And actually, the point is that these models appear not only in dimension 2, but in other dimensions as well. And in fact, in 4 dimensions is perhaps the most interesting case to study. So I'll kind of give a brief overview of this model. So in dimensions 4, 2, and 1, so that eventually you get to one-dimensional models, which is supersymmetric quantum mechanics, in which you can actually calculate a lot of things much more explicitly, but it's already contains sort of the germs of the main phenomena. Okay. So these are the models, once again, supersymmetric models in a particular limit. Which is a radius limit. Quotation, because you also have to fine tune the B field in a particular way, we'll explain. In PD, and weak couplings. In which instantons live, but anti-instantons die. But we're not sorry about this. And the path integral becomes an integral over union of finite dimensional in this key point finite dimensional moduli spaces. So it's sort of a model in which the sort of the infinite dimensionality of the path integral kind of goes away. End up with everything is expressed in terms of finite dimensional integrals. Now, this integral still have to be regularized. So there's a lot of interesting structure. And so these are kind of exactly, so you can think of this as exactly solvable. That is solvable models of Q of T. And actually, we show that they are logarithmic conformal Q of T. Well, in dimensions 24. But in some sense, even in dimension 1. Many of the features of CFT can be seen already in dimension 1. And so the idea is to use them as a starting point of perturbation theory. Leading back to the physical models. Okay, so what are these models?
You don't think it's dangerous to start from non-unitary?
Sorry?
Extremely non-unitary.
Extremely non-unitary, yes. And we recognize that.
Yeah, we do. And then you want to use perturbation theory to recover unitary theory.
Right. But, well, there are other ways. For example, you can also think of S-duality, which kind of can jump you to a physical range of coupling constants. You know, not as a perturbation, but a kind of quantum leap, so to speak. So, well, this is one area in which we haven't yet developed, one area which we haven't yet fully developed, I mean, the least developed area, so to speak. So for now, the question really was to understand these theories. Now, the point is, of course, that even though they are non-unitary and so on and so forth, so at first glance, they look like they are meaningless, but yet, there are already applications to various physical models. For example, this or this. Right? So even before we get to the perturbation theory, it looks kind of worthwhile to study these models on their own, right? Okay. So now, how does this limit work? So this Nikita already basically explained it yesterday in the case of sigma models, but let me just repeat this very briefly. So the point is that you have two types of coupling constants in this model. One is sort of the actual coupling, say in four-dimensional wheels, that's constant G, and then you have a metric G and B bar. So I will, as I said, I want to consider supersymmetric models with enough supersymmetry to kind of not give me trouble in terms of anomalies and such. So actually, we'll assume that X, the target manifold, is a compact Kelly manifold. So then I will write the metric like this as G and B bar. So X will be compact Kelly manifold. So that will be in two-dimensional sigma model. But in addition, you have sort of topological coupling. I don't know if it's the right term for it. But it's a parameter which just counts the number of instantons. So that would be the theta angle in the Young-Mills theory and a B field. And so the idea is to form the complex couplings which combine the two. So that would be in four dimensions would be tau and then tau bar. So assuming that theta and g are real, so then it can be recovered from tau and the tau bar. And likewise, so this is 4D. In 2D, you're going to have tau A B bar, which is D A B bar plus I G A bar over 2. So you have this tau and tau bar, which are complex conjugate to each other in physical theory. But then you say, you hope that the correlation functions that you compute will actually be nice analytic functions of both tau and tau bar. So you can actually treat them as two separate variables, not necessarily complex conjugate to each other. And so then you can play with various limits, since they are not tied together anymore. And the particular limit that I'm talking about is the limit in which tau remains finite and fixed, but tau bar goes to infinity, more precisely minus I infinity. So here is how this can be arranged. So no longer assume that tau bar is complex conjugate to tau, and then take the limit when the coupling constant goes to zero and theta goes to I infinity, right? Minus I infinity. Okay. So that tau remains finite and fixed, and tau bar goes to minus I infinity. Right? So, and likewise, so this is, I describe it in four dimensions. In two dimensions, likewise, you take the metric to infinity, so you kind of rescale the metric with some lambdas, and then you arrange for the B field to be, to have an imaginary part which would offset this term. So it will be negative I times this, right? Plus something finite, which would give me some finite tau in this combination. But here I have a minus sign, so whereas this remains finite, this will actually go to minus I cubed. And so that, so you see that to achieve that, you really need to take imaginary, a theta angle, which is imaginary, plus maybe some small real part. And likewise for the B field. So that's the limit. That's the limit I'm talking about, in which this is this infinite radius limit in 2D, or particular choice, particular choice of weak coupling limit in 4D, in which the instantons survive, but anti instantons disappear. And the reason for this is actually very simple. Let me explain this in two dimensions. And actually, Nikita already did this calculation, but I'll just repeat it very quickly and also show how the first order action shows up. So in this limit, what do we get? So in 4D, in 2D, so let's look at the action of the action. Let's look at the action for the sigma model. So the original sigma model describes maps, say phi from the world sheet to x, and I will choose some local coordinates xa. Coordinates, holomorphic, complex coordinates. And x, and then I will have xa bar, which will be the complex conjugate. And then the action is given by the usual, second order action is given by the usual formula, which is 1/2 gxa bar. Z is the coordinate on sigma, as usual, complex coordinate on sigma. Okay, and so now, so this is the usual action of sigma model, but now we add the B field, right? And so what that means, and my B field is well, maybe more precisely, let me just say that my B field is really a two-form, a closed 1-1 two-form on the target manifold, which I will write like this. And what I will do is I will choose B, in order to achieve this limit, I will choose B in the form minus scalar class, in scalar form, plus some form tau. So I call that this is just 1/2 over 2RG. Okay. So now, okay, so when I do this, what will happen is that this term will give me, so I'm going to get something plus pi of B over sigma, right? And so what this is, so now let me write this out. This will be usual calculation, which is that you will get 1/2 of this part of the B field, which is what I insist on, will give me almost the same expression, except it will be minus sign. right? Because it's antisymmetric. It's a two-form, so it's antisymmetric. So this is
dz bar has to be bar.
Right. And then, of course, I will have some finite piece, which will be just, which I'll just write as far as tau. It's not going anywhere. It's actually going to be fixed. Okay, but now I look at this, and I see that these terms get canceled if I choose it in this way. So these terms, because they have different signs, cancel out. And these terms just equal to each other, so they add up. So the result, the net result of this, is that I get integral of g a d bar dz bar x a dz d bar, right? Just this. And then in brackets plus, I still have some finite b fields, finite sort of remainder of the b field, which I can still use to count inside. And this, of course, is just dz bar of phi absolute value squared, right? Just written out in coordinates, right? And so now what I'm going to do is, so far everything's finite, but now I'm going to take the limit. I'm going to take my limit. And the way I'll do it is I will rescale my metric. In other words, I will put lambda everywhere in front of my metric. I will have lambda here and here and here, right? This remains finite, right? So I'll have here as well, right? And so the result of this is, of course, that when I take the path integral, it will localize on maps for which dz bar vanishes, so holomorphic maps. So this will localize on holomorphic maps because lambda will go to just plus infinity. So this will give me a kind of, if this is not zero somewhere, then this will give me some factor which will just disappear in the limit. So this localizes, becomes integral over holomorphic maps. Now, of course, it's very difficult to work with this action because it sort of blows up. So the standard trick to work with it is to pass to the first order formalism, which Nikita explained last time. And in the first order formalism, this is going to look as follows. I will introduce momenta. Which are dual to coordinates xa, and likewise momenta q a bar. So by the way, to connect with yesterday's talk, I think xa was lambda. It was called lambda, right?
Gamma. Oh, I'm sorry, yes, right.
Well, in the formula, it depends which variables here.
Right, but let's just take gamma, right? It's gamma, and PA is beta.
So beta gamma system, but I will use more traditional notation for coordinates and momenta, just X and P. But these are the beta gammas, really. And so now the action in the first order formalism will be integral over sigma. Minus I dA dz bar xa. That's the action which I wrote at the very beginning of this talk. Minus A d a bar dz xa bar plus 2 over lambda. Since I want to use it, I will that color. It's like, you know, when you watch Almodovar movies, you see red color, you know something's up. So, you know, CP bar. So this is the inverse metric. That's the point. So the problem we had here was we had the metric and we scale it by lambda. But when you pass to the first order formalism, what enters is the inverse metric. And so then it's benign in the limit.
Can I ask you a basic question which is confusing me?
Yes.
Are you in Lorentzian signature or Euclidean signature?
No, of course in Euclidean, because otherwise I wouldn't have instantons.
Why are you doing the minus s?
Well, that's what you do in the...
On Euclidean.
In Euclidean.
Euclidean.
Yes. No, of course it is Euclidean. I mean, it's an important point. Oh, and of course I still have my B field. So now the point is that this action, not B field, by tau field, whatever, which by the way, usually this is called T, and this T bar, but I use tau just to emphasize the connection to this, to the coupling constant Young Mills.
Is there a plus fermions in all these? Or?
Exactly, so that was what I was going to say. Where are the fermions, right? Because I said I'm studying supersymmetric sigma model. But I want to study in this in a way which, in some sense, only uses the fermions just for the fact that it's sort of like get rid of the anomalies. But I don't want to do a topological theory, field theory. In other words, I would also have some fermions. I mean, what I want to study here is a twisted n equal 2 supersymmetric sigma model, type A twisted. And that sort of gives me the best possible scenario in terms of setting up my path integral and so on. So there will actually be fermions which will be super partners of X and P. There will be psi A and pi A momentum associated to them. And likewise for complex conjugate. Right? And so then I will actually have a supercharge, so be supersymmetry here. And in fact, people have studied this model extensively, but they have focused mostly on the so-called topological sector, right? So in other words, topological sector means that you only look at the observables which are annihilated by the supercharge, and you look at the correlation functions of those observables. And then by the usual argument, this correlation function actually depends not on the observable, but on its cohomology class. In other words, if you change the observable by the exact observable, which is an image of the supercharge, the answer will not change, so you only care about the cohomology of the supercharge. And the space of all observables here is huge. We'll talk about this. But the cohomology is very small. The cohomology is actually more or less the cohomology of X itself. It's finite dimensional. So then you have a very limited set of observables, and you try to calculate the correlation functions. Now, the point is that you say, okay, I want to calculate the correlation functions of those observables at finite lambda, right? But actually, the way you calculate is by going to the limit. And the point is that the correlation functions of topological observables is independent of lambda. So you pretend that actually you're doing your calculations in a physical theory. But in fact, you are doing your calculations in this limit. It's just you're lucky that the answer is the same as in the physical theory, right? But now, if you were to take non-topological observables at finite lambda, that wouldn't be true anymore, and you'd be stuck. So instead, what we are proposing is to just take the theory at this limit, when lambda goes to infinity, and look at correlation functions of all observables. Not only topological ones, right? So of course, as a subsector, you will recover the what has been known and what is closely related, of course, also to the mathematical studies of Gromov-Whitman variants. And of course, you can also couple here. I'm sort of talking about just sigma model, but you can also couple to gravity, so you can also have some things coming from moduli curves or complex structures on sigma. And so our idea is to look at this as a full-fledged quantum field theory, like look at the correlation functions of all observables. Then, of course, they do depend on lambda, but we just look at the correlation functions at lambda equal infinity first, and then try to see if we could actually expand in some kind of perturbation theory away from this special point. So why do we insist on not just looking at topological observables. Because, as I said, our original problem was to do bosonic field theory. In bosonic field theory, you don't have, a priori, any supercharge, right? You don't expect any to have. Of course, in if you have other things, then you might have supercharge, like in superstrings. But if you just look at the sigma model by itself, it's not going to have a supercharge. So if we are to say anything about it, we'll have to work in such a way that we don't use the supercharge. Right, so that's why the title of the talk is, in some terms, beyond topological theory. We're looking at this model beyond the topological sample. Okay.
Things always independent of how you take the limits. Could there be one of the lambdas or a log lambdas?
Could there be? You mean when you expand?
It could be poles, which flow up from lambda plus one.
There could be poles, I suppose.
But you don't get them.
Well, we look.
Functions
we get are finite, and if we believe that the space of observables somehow is the same, then I guess.
Unless you take some crazy observables, reasonable observables from the point of view of sigma model, you can.
Right. So in other words, all the reasonable observables from the finite lambda make sense at infinite lambda, and the collision functions we get are going to be finite. So what are they? What are these collision functions? So, first of all, let me just finish this calculation. So, you have one action, and then you have another action. There's a second order, and there's a first order, but the point is that they're equivalent to each other, because you can eliminate, so first order, you can eliminate the momenta, and substitute back, and you will just end up with this. This is the usual calculation, which already Nikita mentioned yesterday. Now, the point is that now we can take the limit when lambda goes to infinity. When lambda goes to infinity, this will disappear. And so that means that the action which should describe our theory is this action. It's just this action. Which is exactly plus fermion. So in principle, we could have fermions. And by the way, as far as fermions are concerned, of course, I'm not forcing myself, for example, here to take, in general, the twisted model. I could take the physical model where fermions are half forms, for example. Since I'm not insisting on, I'm not going to use the supercharge, I don't care so much, right? So I could use different twists, or no twists at all, or no fermions at all, in principle. So you may or may not have some fermions here. The fermions are already in the first order, so that's why we don't need to do anything with the fermions. So now, what happened? What happened is that before holomorphic maps for the second order action were instantons. The equation of holomorphy was not the equation of motion. The equation of motion was Laplace equation. But in this limit, what happened is that now the equation of holomorphy has become the equation of motion. So the equation of motion is just dc bar xa is equal to zero. And these are the equations which describe the instantons. And perhaps I should comment that you can do similar analysis in 4D, similar a limit in 4D. And what will happen is that you will also get a first order action in which the equations of motions will be the self-duality equations, the instanton equations, right? So that here the instantons are the instantons, and the anti-instantons are the anti-instantons. And so what will happen is that, again, in this limit, the instantons will survive and the anti-instantons will disappear, right? So you get equations of motions So now, what does it mean for the path integral? Well, what it means is that, well, if you write e to the minus s by a kind of standard picture of Fourier analysis, you see that the integral over all maps is going to localize just on the holomorphic maps, right? So more precisely, what you're going to have is, it's going to be a sum. So let's say you have some observables, O(n). So this will be the sum over second homology classes over x, which count the instantons. And this finite part of the B field will just know about this homology class.
So this will contribute the factor e to the minus integral tau over beta. Tau, I recall, is a two form. Tau is. Let me write it here. Tau is just a two, as a one one. Two form on x.
So this is what I use to sort of separate contributions from different instanton numbers. Instanton numbers are the second homology classes. So I'll get this coefficient here. And then I will have an integral over, let's call it m beta, which will be, m beta is the moduli space. Moduli space of holomorphic maps. I from sigma to x such that the image of the homology class sigma is beta. And this is a finite dimensional moduli space. So now what kind of observables can I have? So the typical observables, the simplest observables, which actually are the subject of interest in topological field theory, are differential forms on X. More precisely, closed differential forms. Right? So, in the topological sector, closed differential forms. On X. So if you have a differential form, right? So locally, you can represent the differential form, say, in the following ways. You'll have some A1, AN, and then maybe B1 bar, BM bar. And this will be some function of X, you know, XI, XJ bar. And then you'll have dx a1, wedge dx an, wedge dx bar, dx b1 bar, wedge dx dm bar. Right? So if you have such a differential form, you associate to the operator where you just keep this formula of xx bar, same one, but here you just replace it by the fermions. And as I said, you have. Now I'm actually really putting myself in an equal to a type A twisted model, so that I have the fields psi and pi conformal of dimension 0 and 1, right? So it's functions and one forms, and likewise with the complex conjugates. So then what I'll do is I'll just take psi A1, psi AN, psi B1 bar. So this is topological sector in n equal to type A twisted sigma model. Let's now finally restrict to this one, this particular setup. B1 psi BM. So these are the observables which I can insert in the path integral. And so what I need to do is to integrate these observables over this moduli space. So what does it mean? Well, they're natural evaluation maps, because I should have said that, say, these observables are located at some points P1, PN, on my Riemann surface sigma, right? So I've got these points, P1, PN, and then I've got observables, O1, ON, which I want to calculate the correlation function of. Now, I can pull back the differential forms, which, if the observables are differential forms, I can pull them back to this moduli space in the usual way, because, well, well, the moduli space consists of maps, and the map, and I have fixed points. So if I have a map and a point, I can evaluate the map at the point, so I get a point of the target manifold. That's why, let me emphasize maybe here that, yes, this is a moduli space of maps of degree beta. So I have evaluation maps, FPI, from this moduli space to X, namely phi, which is a map from sigma to X, right, goes to the value of phi, FPI. Okay. You have a map from sigma to X, and then you've got your point PI go somewhere. So then for each, that means that to each map, which is a point of the moduli space, I associate the point of X. So I have such maps. Right? And now I have a differential form, omega I here, and I can pull it back. By this evaluation map. And I can take the wedge product. Right? And then I can integrate over this modulus. So that's this term. That's what I call. That's the integral of O1 ON over N beta. If indeed OI comes from differential form. So let's call this omega. And then call this omega hat absorbable, corresponding to the differential form. Right. So this is well, this is mathematically very well defined. Now, oh, not yet actually, because the point is that this moduli space is non-compact. So a priori, the integral may diverge. But in fact, one can show that if you choose, if your differential forms are just smooth differential forms on your target manifold, then this integral will converge. And the way this is done is by using, one of the ways to do it is to use the compactification of this moduli space. And the best known compactification is the Kantsevich compactification, moduli stable maps, where you kind of allow some bubbles to form at sigma, with some non-trivial maps to X. And this moduli space is already compact, and the point is that the evaluation maps extend to the compactification. So that means that your moduli space actually sits inside some compact moduli space to which, and these are well-defined smooth differential forms, which actually extend to the boundary. So your integral is really integral to compact moduli space, so it is actually finite. So this is not the correlation function, this is one of the coefficients in the correlation function. Now, of course, I'm ignoring other issues. There are issues with zero modes and so on. So, for example, for Calabi-Yau, there is a virtual fundamental class you have to integrate rather than the naive sort of moduli space. So I'm kind of ignoring this. Although, say, for a target manifold like P1, things work out very nicely without all these complications. But so this is basically what... this is an example of a correlation function. And it is indeed the correlation function in this theory, in this limit, because in this theory, you really... the path integral just becomes an integral over the moduli space of holomorphic maps, which is a union of components labeled by beta. Each of these components is a finite dimensional space. So now, of course, the point is that if you are within the topological sector, you are forcing yourself to take just closed differential forms. Why? Because the supercharge, the action of the supercharge on the absorbables corresponding to differential forms is just the action of the Durham differential. So if you are looking at the topological sector, that means you look at observables which are annihilated by the supercharge. So you have to look at the closed differential forms. And this already, you look at it, and it's very unnatural, because you got such a nice formula, which works for any differential form. Nowhere did I say that omega is closed, right? You get an answer for any handful of differential forms. So why stop at closed differential forms? You can might as well consider all differential forms. So then you already go outside of the topological sector. But you can actually do much more than this, right? Because so far you have used up only the fields XA, XA bar, right? And you've used just the fermions, psi A, M psi A bar. So what are the other possible observables that you can have? Well, obviously you can take derivatives of this. Right? You can take the first thing you can do is you can just take derivatives. So the much bigger class much bigger class of observables is obtained if you consider all polynomials, say, in Xa's and their derivatives, and the complex conjugate, right?
So any polynomial,
say, any polynomial function.
Well, you don't even have to consider polynomial, but that would be the simplest case. But take any function of this, and
then take a product of derivatives of psi a's, say like this, over I. You can take derivatives of psi, and you can take derivatives of psi bars as well. So this is already a much larger class of observables. And of course, that's not all, because here we're only using the coordinates and their superpartners, x and psi, but we also have momenta. So we also have pa's, for example, and pi's, and their complex conjugates. So we can use those to cook up observables, say, corresponding to vector fields on our target manifold, because pa is like ddx, right? So in fact, vector fields on your target manifold are well-defined observables in your theory. And you might be interested in the correlation functions of these vector fields and differential forms. So then you can ask, why didn't we see those observables before? And a very simple reason, because if you look at the observable corresponding to the vector field, and the observable corresponding to vector field more precisely would be, since we are in a supersymmetric situation, it would be natural to look at the lead derivative. So it's kind of vector field acting on differential forms, right? So say V is a vector field. V is a vector field on X. And you can look at the lead derivative as an observable of your theory. You just contract very easily. You know, whenever you have ddxa, you just replace it by pa. And you put some normal ordering. Do kind of a split point normalization, like Nikita explained yesterday. Although in the supersymmetric case, things work out much more nicely. That you don't get those anomalies that he was talking about yesterday. So now, why can't we see them in the Gromov-Witten theory? And there is a very simple explanation, because they are exact. There is a Cartan formula which says that the lead derivative is a super anticommutator of the Durand differential and the contraction. The Durand differential is our supercharge. So that means that this is Q exact. So if you insert it in the correlation function with some topological observables, which is going to be zero. Right? So that's why we don't see them. And more generally, we could look at differential operators of order higher than one. And actually, mathematicians have studied these objects. Say you can look at just holomorphic ones, and under the name of chiral Durand complex. And there was sort of one of the puzzling questions was, why don't we see the chiral Durand in the topological field theory? Well, there's a very simple explanation, because of this, because they're exact. But now that we look at more general observables, not necessarily topological ones, these are becoming good observables. They're going to give us non-trivial correlation functions. And we already see that our theory actually possesses a large number of chiral fields in general, because you can have holomorphic vector fields. Let's say if you have a compact manifold, say you may not have holomorphic differential forms, compact Kähler manifold, but say on CP1, you don't have any holomorphic differentials, but you have holomorphic vector fields, usually. So these holomorphic vector fields are going to contribute to your chiral algebra. So this is the first indication that your theory in this limit actually is conformal, even if your target manifold is not Calabi-Yau. Of
course, when you go back, you will get some beta function if your target manifold is not as on Calabi-Yau. But in this limit, for any compact Keeler manifold, you are going to end up with a conformal field theory. So in other words, there is a huge space of fields of observables. And so what we did in part two of our project is that we described in more detail the correlation functions of observables of this form. And so these observables, like which correspond to just differential forms, in other words, they just depend on x and psi, but not on their derivatives, are called evaluation observables because they come from this evaluation mass. So we call these observables jet evaluation observables. Jet evaluation, because it has to do with jets. And I don't mean the football team, but I mean jets of mass. Jet evaluation observables. So how does it work? I guess my talk is it considered as a pedagogical? Like, have I earned this? Because Nathan explained to me that pedagogical talks are allowed to go longer for 1 hour. So far I've done my best to convince you that it's a pedagogical. But now I can just I don't care anymore, so I'll go very fast.
Just a question about what these correlators depend on. I mean, in the A model, we only depend on the symmetric structure of the target.
That's right.
Because now you're...
Now, of course, they depend on complex structure.
Everything. Complex
structure. That's right.
Most importantly, it depends on where you insert the motion.
Right. So one of the things was... There are all kinds of things that you could change, and because if things are Q-closed, then you don't feel that, right? But now that you don't insist on Q-close. The what?
Now we talk about the spectrum of the theory.
The spectrum of the theory, exactly. Yes, and of course, the point is that on all those observables have a particular feature that the Hamiltonian acts by zero on them, on those guys. Even on all differential forms. So what you're describing has no dynamics. But now, of course, these observables will have non-zero value of Hamiltonian. So these are kind of a much more...
You never need to act anything Q-exact to action for regularization.
I'm sorry?
You never need to act anything Q-exact to your action for regularization.
I never need to...
Well, the simple question depends on the action.
Sorry?
This correlation functions also depends on the action. If you add to the action something Q-exact, they would change.
That's right. That's right.
But sometimes you need to add something Q-exact for regularization.
Right.
To regularize the
system. So I'm going to talk about regularization now.
Ah, okay.
So the mechanism of regularization is kind of slightly unusual. But in fact, not so much. If you think about it more.
Okay, now you can do compact or non-compact. You haven't distinguished. X can be non-compact.
Right. So if X is non-compact, of course, there are all kinds of issues, zero modes. Right, so then you have to regularize zero modes. So that's why it's better to look at the compact case. But if you have a way to regularize zero modes, then...
And then we put to Andre's question. Then we get to Andre's question, I think. Once you have to regularize zero modes, I think...
Then regularization might be dependent on...
So we don't want to add back the original term.
Okay. Right. So one example, a good example to keep in mind is CP1. So compact. Already you get something, many non-trivial things.
X is non-compact, we can actually consider the observables which are sort of supported near some point in target space. So if your omega is something like a delta function or smear delta function, then the integral will not be there. So you regularize by the choice of observables.
Does this relate? So suppose I just do ordinary baked again. So Berlindian.
Yeah.
Is this going to reduce to that in that case?
I think beta gamma were not a spin zero, so there was no meaning of target space.
Okay. You could have generalized, but I think you did for any conformal.
So if gamma is non-zero spin, then the only way to regularize it is to put delta function in there.
But if
gamma is equal to zero, you can put delta function of gamma minus phi phi.
So let me just say a few words about what is the kind of geometric meaning of these jet depilation absorbables and what their correlation functions are going to look like. So the space of in the study of this model, we are naturally left with moduli space of holomorphic maps from sigma, which is a compact Riemann surface, to X. But this space has a local model, which is maps from a small disk, holomorphic maps from a small disk to X. That's called a jet space. Or space of terms of holomorphic maps, right? So the jet space is a space of maps from D to X, where D is a holomorphic maps. Holomorphic maps, where D is a small disk. You can actually think of it as a kind of a formal disk. A mathematician would say formal disk. So in other words, you can see the maps. If it's a small disk, the maps, you can write such a map as a, what's it called, a phi. So phi is described, say, locally as by a bunch of t is a coordinate on d on the disk. You can write it as a sum of x to the x. Since it's a map from a small disk, it will end up in some particular chart, coordinate chart, and so you could just write it as this power series. Now, if you insist on a small disk of some radius, you would insist on some convergence condition here. But you might as well just look at the kind of a formal disk. In other words, maps from a formal disk would be all power series like this without imposing any convergence condition. Right? And so now the point is that you can think of, you can when you write it like this, it's the same as writing it, you know, as DXA ST=0. So instead of thinking of the coefficients, you can think of the derivatives of X at the origin of this disk.
T is a radial? What is T?
T is a coordinate on the disk. Just a holomorphic. It's embedded in the complex plane. So it's just coordinate. Yeah. And so that means that what are the natural coordinates on this space? Well, natural coordinates on X are XA. Coordinates on this space are the coefficients, or if you will, the derivatives of the map at zero. So DMXA. And we're now A equals to 1 in the dimension of X, and n is greater than equal to 0, are natural coordinates on the jet space. And so that means that these polynomials that I was talking about, these functions, are functions on the jet space. Right? So this is a function of the jet space. And then this whole thing would correspond to a differential form on the jet space, where this derivatives of psi, you know, psi itself corresponds to dx, you know, dxa or dx d bar, and derivatives of psi would correspond to the d, so psi, d n psi, say, would correspond to d of dn. Right. So in other words, the jet evaluation observables are nothing but differential forms on the jet space. So let's call the jet space JX.
Jet space is infinite dimensional.
That's right, it's infinite dimensional.
Yeah, it's better to think about jet spaces than just to think about points on the sigma.
Well, but here the idea is that before, so let's look at this picture. Before, we were just looking at the value of the map at this point, right? But in fact, this map has a lot more data. first of all, it has the values everywhere. But if we just look in the neighborhood of a point, we don't see other points, but we see derivatives of this map, right? So that's the idea. That we kind of it's a kind of a trade-off between the values at all points, but and derivatives at this point. But this is what gives us a way to calculate the correlation function, to set up the correlation function for this more general observables. Just the fact that in addition to the evaluation map, which we talked about here, what is the evaluation map? The evaluation map says, whenever you have a map phi and you fix your point, you actually get a point of x. So that allows you to pull back differential form from x. But now I'm going to generalize this, right, to actually a map with a kind of jet evaluation. There's a jet evaluation map. Let me do it here. Jet evaluation map. Yeah. From the moduli space of holomorphic maps, where again an element, a point here is just a map for the signal to x. But now to J. Because if I have a map, not only do I have, it's a smooth map, it's a holomorphic map actually. Not only do I have the value of the map, but I have a first derivative, a second derivative, and so on. Right? So of course I have to specify to actually do that, I have to specify coordinates. The local coordinates at this point. There is a way to do it without coordinates, but it's just, let's just not worry about it. So let's assume that we are given coordinates. That's called PI. Coordinates at the point PI. So then we have this map, which to phi associates, first of all, phi at the point PI, and then the first derivative of phi at PI, and second derivative. And when I say d phi, I really mean the collection of d x a.
You see, when the incident chart is fixed, then the first phi number of first coefficients will determine before the incident series. And
right.
When the incident number is finite, the finite number of first coefficients will determine the whole map. But as we talk about arbitrary incident charge, in fact, you can have an infinite data to derive.
It's not
the same. So if you target CP1 and the sphere and the check is going to charge K, then the map is joined by 2K plus 1 parameters. So if you take point and express 2K plus 1 derivatives, then you know the whole map. You don't fix K.
That's right. So each moduli space, but beta for a fixed instanton charge, is finite dimensional. So therefore, if we know enough of those guys, we'll know the map, right? But since we also, like you said, we want to know them for all beta, it's not really overdetermined system of coordinates.
So, may I ask, so this little d is like this recharge?
This d, no, it's just the derivative.
Below.
This?
The d on the right hand side.
Ah, no, it's just, I mean, like, if you have, let's just say, let's m be a manifold.
Yeah.
And if you have coordinates.
You interpret it like the Durham charge.
Yeah, so that would be like.
Fermions.
Right, so the question is does it act exactly as a supercharge? Right? Yeah, I think so. You're right, yes.
And it's D on, it's like the Durham differential on X. Or?
It's a Durham differential on the jet space.
On the jet space.
Right, exactly. So D is Q, but restricted to this type of observables. The supercharge actually preserves this type of observables, and what it does is, of course, we are used to the fact that xA goes to psi A, but not only that, also dxA will go to d psi A and so on, right? So it preserves this space, and what it is, since this space is a space of differential forms on the jet space, it just is
the Durham differential on the jet space.
That's a very good point. So, okay, so you have these maps now. Yes?
Could you do the usual Clavijo A model? So yes? What are you computing now with this extra stuff?
What I'm computing is I'm introducing new observables. I mean, not new observables, but observables which depend not only on the...
This is not the A model. A model does not consider these observables.
Well, it depends what you call by A
sorry.
Model.
Sorry, I mean, okay, if you, instead of doing the A model, you do this. So what are you computing in the target space?
Right, so the...
traditionally, what you're computing is correlation functions of differential forms or closed differential forms on X.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is that in this model, there are other observables. Those observables are not necessarily differential forms on X, but they are differential forms on the jet space of X. And for those observables, the theory should also give you correlation functions. And I want to understand what they are.
Yeah, like in the effective action, in the four-dimensional effective action.
What is the meaning of this?
Yeah, what's the meaning four dimensions of this term?
I'm talking about the group.
Like D terms? You can put in D?
Yes. It's a D term. Because these all come from Q Z transfers.
Yeah, so you can be the
Some of them are Q Z, some of them are not. Yeah.
So you can compute the spectrum on theory and how the other.
In the limit,
it's
limit alpha prime goes to zero.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, all right, and so what I can do now is I can play the same game. Before I use the evaluation maps to add a differential form here, I pull it back to the moduli space and I integrate. Right? So now I can pull back with respect to these maps. So I will have now a bunch of differential forms, single one omega n, on the jet space now. So they will, the corresponding observables, will now be observables of this time. So they will depend on X and its derivatives, and psi and its derivatives, right? So the correlation functions of these observables now will again be the integral, will be given by the sum, more precisely it's going to be again the sum over betas, and of course, as usual, only certain positive classes corresponding to the Keeler form will appear, but I'll just write it like this. E to the minus tau over beta. And then you will have integral. Then you will have integral over m beta. And then here you will have, you will now take the jet evaluation map at ti. And then you will pull back your form omega I. And then you take the wedge product. So just like in this formula, right? Just like in this formula, but you now taking advantage of this full jet evaluation map, not just values but all derivatives, and you can then accommodate these more general operators. So what this means is that we have to study this integral, and these integrals are natural generalization of these integrals which we know are important. You know, number of Witten variants and so on. So what we get a kind of a jet version, jet generalization of Abramov-Witten variants. So naively you would think that, well, great, so this is done, so we just calculate this and we should get some new invariants and so on. But actually it turns out that this, calculating this invariance, this integrals, is much more tricky than calculating the ordinary invariants. And the reason is, again, the fact that m beta is not compact. So what you can do is try to apply the same argument as before. Deal with this, right? And the argument was that this actually sits inside this compactification, which is moduli of stable maps defined by Katsevich, right? And so then, if you could show that the jet evaluation maps extend, then this would mean that these forms extend, and therefore the integral does converge. That's what happens for the ordinary evaluation observables. The ordinary evaluation maps do extend. The point is that what can happen, for example, is in Katsevich compactification, is that the sigma can actually change. The sigma can grow a bubble, for example, at your point. But then your point will actually be sitting here. So what will happen is that you will just be taking the value of your map at this point.
It's a definition?
This is definition, right. Definition will be so that in this moduli space, you will allow pictures like this. So in other words, the compactification is not the moduli map from sigma to X. It's the moduli space of maps of sigma and some other kind of curve, Riemann surfaces, to X.
But where exactly on the bubble? Where?
It's part of the moduli.
That's right. So the point is that this would be, your moduli space will consist of all, the moduli space will consist of sigma of this type and points on this, right? And so the when you go to the boundary, this point will migrate to this point on the bubble. Okay? But whatever it is, The map is defined on the whole thing because the moduli space is defined as a moduli of maps of such creatures, right? So anyway, you know where each point goes. So the evaluation map extends, and because the evaluation map extends, you can
sort of have evaluation pi bar from m beta bar to x.
So instead of pulling back to here and integrating, you can pull back to here and integrate. But here is compact, so that's why the integral converges. N is equal to bigger than you are gluing something of measure zero. So the integral is not going to change because of this, right? Now, if we want to use the same argument, in our case, we would have to make sure that the jet evaluation maps also extend. But this is much more problematic because we are not just talking about the value, but we are talking about the derivative or derivatives. And if you look more closely, you will see that actually the jet evaluation maps do not extend. And precisely because the point sort of moves to this bubble. And so therefore, there is no well-defined notion of derivative which extends to the boundary of this moduli space. And so the result of this is that when you start calculating these integrals, it looks like a benign thing because this moduli space is still finite dimensional. And you can actually describe it very explicitly, say, in the case of target CP1 or something like this. And you can describe these pullbacks very explicitly. You get some differential forms. And you will see that they will have singularities at the boundary. So the integral diverges. So, of course, but, you know, for physicists, this is bread and butter. I mean, it's great. It doesn't diverge, it's great, so we'll have to regularize it. But this already, it indicates that there is something going on, right? There's some phenomenon going on. Because you try to regularize it. How do you regularize it? And so we use a kind of Epstein-Glaser procedure. In other words, we do sort of a cutoff, so we integrate up to some epsilon, right? And then take the sort of finite part. That's kind of a natural thing to do. But as always happens with regularizations, this procedure is not unique because you can take epsilon or you can take 2 epsilon or whatever, right? And so if you look at the answer, you will see that the answer will depend on the choice of regularization. Sorry? Ah, well, so you have so you'll have your moduli space m beta, and this will and it's some codification. So there will be some divisor. There will be some boundary divisor, right? So it will be m beta bar, say, and then say m beta is a complement of this, right? So when you calculate your integral, you will see your differential form. Your differential form has a pool and a boundary divisor. Right? And so you will have to regularize, you will calculate the integral up to sort of radius epsilon to the boundary device. Well, it's kind of more going to be like the two kind of
physical meaning of this epsilon.
What is the physical meaning of this epsilon?
Something like the problem happens when the instant dot on very small size sits on top of the observer. This is where this derivative starts going up.
Right.
So you don't let this instant to be too small, just approach the observer.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Instant
with
small size are basically zero
approach. So the derivative goes, so the derivative becomes very large.
So your regularization is that keep the zeros and the poles apart or keep them apart from the observer. You could do it just on the instants and long, but you're not cut off on that.
Well, we want to define this observer point.
So this is, there are different ways of thinking about it. One point is that this observable needs more precise definition than just write it as a product of free fields.
Right. So in other words,
at this point we don't let down this instant touch the observer.
Right, so in other words, there is a...
Define the operator. You want to define an operator which looks in the predominant limit like that, but in fact it's what it's like.
So in other words, there is a certain geometric phenomenon here of these sort of small instantons, and that causes divergence. And so then we have to regularize, and when we regularize that, it means that regularizing means that we actually
the need for regularization actually means that our picture was too naive. That just writing this formula does not really define a bona fide observable in our theory. It's actually ill-defined. But it's actually defined up to something, up to additional something. And this is the first indication of the logarithmic nature of our theory. The point is that actually what happens is that the Hamiltonian of this model is not diagonalizable. And so if you have a diagonalizable Hamiltonian, you have eigenstates, which are kind of, let's say, well, pretty much well-defined. But if you have a Jordan block, then you'll have one eigenstate, which is well-defined, and then another state would be well-defined up to addition of something, right? Of the eigenstate. And so therefore, that's exactly the phenomenon that we're seeing here, that the fact that we need this regularization actually means that this a bona fide operator in the theory is not this differential form on the jet space. It's rather some subquotient of the space of observables. To promote it to an honest observable, we have to not only specify this differential form, but we have to specify a particular choice of regularization of all of its correlation functions. And so that, in order to understand this puzzle better, what we did actually is we looked at the even simpler version of this theory, which happens in dimension one, so because we're still in quantum mechanics. So as I said, this has three parts, and I started with part three because that's the most relevant one, still unwritten part three, which is the most relevant one to pure spinners and to the subject of this conference. And I spent most of my time discussing part two, which has to do with supersymmetric sigma models. Now, in part one, we look at the kind of we're trying to understand what this is all about. We looked at one-dimensional models, one-dimensional supersymmetric, which means supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so the simplest example would be when we have quantum mechanics on, say, CP1, and then we have the Morse function. Say one way to think about it is in terms of the Morse function. So you will have some gradient flows of the Morse function, which will be going from North Pole to South Pole. And this will be, so of course now it's quantum mechanics, so we're studying maps from interval to sigma rather than from sigma, right? And the instantons are the gradient trajectories. Anti-instantons would be anti-gradient trajectories, which would be going from south to north, but we band them in this limit. So this limit works exactly the same way. And the moduli, the analog of the moduli space of instantons is the moduli space of gradient trajectories, right? And so the path integral description gives you a definition of correlation functions as integrals over this moduli space of gradient trajectories. But then we wanted to understand, so this is a Lagrangian approach, but then we wanted to understand the Hamiltonian structure. And the Hamiltonian structure would be that you want to have some space of states, and you would observables would be some operators in the space of states. You would want to recover these correlation functions given by these nice integrals in terms of a matrix coefficients of these operators. And when in doing that, we saw that somehow the usual paradigm, so the usual picture we have in mind when we talk about quantum mechanics, breaks down in this limit. We're used to the following picture, that the space of states is just the L2 space of your manifold, which here is a supersymmetric case, so this will be essentially differential forms on F, right? And the Hamiltonian is like Laplace operator, some second order operator. But instead, what we get here is a completely different picture, because first of all, our operator is not second order, it's first order. So how can it possibly have a bounded spectrum in this case, right? So that's the first puzzle. The second puzzle is we want our action is a sum of two terms which involves holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates in this limit. So that would mean that we expect the space of states to be a tensor product of chiral and anti-chiral. But if you look at differential forms on P1, say, they don't break into differential holomorphic, tensor, anti-holomorphic, right? So the solution to the puzzle is actually that when you take this limit, you really change the space of states in a very violent way. And what happens with it is that it breaks into two pieces. Two pieces because you have two critical points. So one sort of has to do with North Pole, and the other one has to do with the South Pole. And the space of states
sort of, you may think it's kind of bad news, but actually it's good news because the space of states becomes much more algebraic. The first piece is essentially differential forms just on the complement of these forms. So it's just differential forms on, instead of CP1, just on C. So they're just polynomial differential forms. And of course they do split into holomorphic and anti-holomorphic. And on the other hand, the other piece is distributions supported at this point. So you have delta function here, and then you can apply derivatives, holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. So again, it splits into two, into holomorphic and anti-holomorphic. And naively, your space of states is a direct sum of this and this. But the point is that actually it's not a direct sum, but it's a non-trivial extension. And it is this non-triviality of extension that gives, that makes the Hamiltonian non-diagonalizable. It actually develops Jordan blocks. And so that's what we analyzed in this part one. And so we kind of, so the naive expectation is almost correct, that you kind of get conformal field theory, but you actually get a logarithmic. So and the logarithmic nature of it is caused directly by the instantons. The point is that your Jordan blocks are going to look something like this. So you have some, the Hamiltonian is going to have some eigenvalue delta. But then there will be an upper triangular term, which will be something like e to the I tau. And the point is that when you go back to the physical theory, you're going to have minus I tau bar. So it becomes efficient. But in your limit, when tau bar goes to minus I infinity, it disappears. And you have, and instantons only show up in the upper triangular part of the matrix. So the matrix becomes non-diagonalizable. And so in the quantum mechanical picture, therefore, you see this way the baby version of this phenomenon of divergence of the collision functions and the need for regularization. And the sort of the meaning of this regularization from the point of view, from the Hamiltonian point of view. In other words, what is the space of space and what is the space of operators in the theory? So I'm out of time, so I better stop here.
Do you have any results on, if you really regard this as the first, you know, the leading term in a one over lambda expansion, the correction of lambda to zero doesn't mean that there's only
We have a couple of results.
In
quantum mechanics, we have calculated some terms and expansions, so it seems to work. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in principle, one could also try to do a kind of S-duality argument, because in S-duality, tau goes minus 1 over tau, right? So you may think that even when you decouple tau and tau bar, they would still, this duality will still work, right? And so then, of course, what will happen is that here you have minus I infinity, so this will go to 0, and tau will go to some finite value. So you'll get from this point that we studied, you get a point where tau is finite, but tau bar is 0. Of course, it's still not a physical point, but it's already a point with a finite value of both coupling constants. So maybe from that point, then you can deform further. That's another possibility.
Could you have boundaries to a Rothschild?
Yes. That's a good point, right? So, we, in other words, look at some brains and categories of brains, and we haven't really studied this in detail, but that seems like one of the first questions.
Here we're discussing the simple model, so we don't couple with two-dimensional gravity. But it's not quite clear whether you can couple logarithmic theory to two dimensions.
No, but here I think
so
the correlation of this
model can be discussed.
Right. At least this, for this observables, this makes sense, right?
If you vary sigma.
You have to write your boundary terms in this first order formalism. I'm not sure how you do that. Right, there are boundary terms in the Wolff-Schmidt action.
Yes.
A couple to GS or to P. Precisely what you do.
I think maybe D modules are the word that one can see, because P is DDX, right? So maybe brains here are D modules, but.